Good morning. The administration committee meeting will now begin. For the record, this is a virtual meeting and all board members and participants are by telephone. I will now take roll call. Board member Morocco?
Here.
Board member Adams?
Here.
Board member Rajmani?
Here.
Board member Gordon?
Here.
Board member Rasmussen?
Here.
Thank you. Operator, we would like to open the floor for public comments. Can you please provide instructions for entering the queue to make a public comment?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is now open for public comments. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad to enter the queue. You will hear a brief tone to indicate you have successfully entered the queue. Priority access will be given to any participant who has pre-registered, and these comments will be taken in turn. We will then take public comments from remaining participants on a first-come, first-served basis. Each person will have 2 minutes for their public comment. A warning will be provided when 15 seconds remain. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now to enter the queue to make a public comment. There is one speaker in the queue for public comment. Apologies, there are two participants in the queue for public comment at this time. The first public comment is coming from Ryan Felmet. Ryan, your line is live and your time will begin now.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I'm just kind of quickly looking through this administration deck and kind of following off of the last meeting where some of these financial issues came up as it relates to the MTA. And somebody mentioned basically that the OPEX of the MTA is far greater than it is at New Jersey Transit. So the CARES Act funding that was received at New Jersey Transit was a higher percentage as it relates to OPEX. And that's great. We got more bang for our buck in terms of free money or whatever you want to call it from the Fed. But I don't think that behooves us from looking at other types of structural changes that are based on what the 12,000 rank and file and corporate office are seeing and board members as well, and Mr. Corbett, in terms of what do we see over the next couple of years and are we preparing for it? Or from what the public sees, it's more like a business as usual and we're plugging revenue gaps with FAERS Act funding. So I would like to see if there's any key metrics that senior management and specifically the board is monitoring as it relates to CARES Act funding, because it's likely that we'll receive another chunk and at some point in time that money's going to run out. So are we operating, the simple question, are we operating as business as usual in terms of employees, staffing, funding? Because during the last presentation, it made it sound like everything's okay and squeaky clean, but for years, there's been talk about moving money from capital project to operations and things like that, even under normal circumstances. So I find it highly irresponsible to make comments that make it look like things are rosy and peachy clean. 15
seconds remaining.
And then as it relates to the Academy bus, outside of the, we should walk through an example of all the departments and all of the issues. If you do a virtual example of what happened at the Academy bus issue and how it came to light and all of the departments that it missed and all the gaps and controls, I'd like to see that play out regardless of how the legal situation ends. So I think that's something to be looked at. Those are my comments.
I'm running out concluded. Of
time. Thank you.
And there's one additional person in the public comment queue at this time. That is Robert Hale. Robert, your line is live and your time will begin now.
Hey, thank you very much. It's good to be back speaking to you folks again. I want to give credit where it's due. It was good that Governor Murphy canceled the Academy contract. And I'd like to encourage him and you board members and your management team to take a look at another line item in your capital plan. And at risk of sounding like a broken record, that would be the acquisition of more Bombardier multi-levels. You're going to find that those cars are overweight and overpriced relative to cars that are in service all over Europe. What you should be doing instead of buying those overweight double-deck multi-levels that are slower to accelerate, brake, and turn over passengers than other cars is to buy single-level electric multiple units that have their own propulsion systems. You're going to find that the decreased travel time due to their improved acceleration, braking, and passenger turnover actually cancels out the slightly reduced seat count compared to your Bombardier multi-levels. Those Bombardier multi-levels, you think they're two decks and they double the seats. They don't. They only increase your seats by 12% versus an aero. They're not a good buy, and they're not a good solution for a capacity-constrained system like you've got with the North River tunnels. They handle 24 trains per hour. That's actually not exceptional. You have two-track systems going up to 30, even 32 trains per hour. Better handling trains would almost certainly let you fit more trains in to Penn Station during the peak hour. It's time to take a fresh look at this procurement and not continue along with business as usual. Thanks so much.
Thank you. There are no further public comments at this time.
Thank you. Next is the financial update, Jeff Bernstein.
Thank you, Joyce, and good morning. I'm pleased to present New Jersey Transit's financial update for the period July 1st, 2020 through October 31st, 2020. Additional information related to key performance indicators, vacancy trends, revenue ridership, and P&L details not presented can be found in the appendix. In the first slide, through the 4 months ending October 31st, 2020, New Jersey Transit's net loss from operations was $346.7 million, which was partially offset by a $320 million CARES Act reimbursement. Less than $4.5 million loss related to the timing of reimbursable project revenue for a total net loss of $31.2 million. This compares to last year where we reported a $7 million gain from operations and a $2.5 million loss due to the timing of reimbursable project revenue. In comparison, last month we reported a $318.4 million net loss from operations and a total loss of $51.7 million. Compared to budget, net income from operations is favorable by $20.8 million. This includes favorable operating revenue of $8.1 million and expenses being favorable to budget by $12.7 million. Passenger revenue remains substantially below prior year levels, however, is $11 million or 14% above budget as of October 31st. Note, though, that favorability to budget has narrowed significantly in October and appears to be trending unfavorable. This trend will be more evident on the following slide. On the expense side, relative to budget, labor and fringe expenses are favorable by $12.1 million or 2.6%. as most of the new hires over the past several months have been filled essential positions. Purchase transportation costs are $2.7 million or 4.0% below budget, and other expenses are unfavorable by $2.1 million or 1.1%, mainly due to the timing of COVID-related materials, supplies, and services. The next slide is a more detailed view of passenger revenues compared to both budget and prior year. The dotted line at the top of each graph is the pre-COVID baseline, while the dashed and solid lines represent the fiscal 21 slow and steady budget, as well as our fiscal 21 actuals. Revenues by all modes have flattened, if not begun declining, from September through October 2020. We expect this trend to continue throughout the second wave, as we are currently experiencing slight declines, as November's preliminary revenue is currently expected to be $3 to $4 million below budget.
Jeff, this is Bill Vicaire. If I could just interrupt you for a second, interject a comment before you move on. I'd like to emphasize for the board, the committee members, a few things, as there's a lot going on this slide, and I want to make sure that they don't get lost. So the first is just to recall that for each of the first 3 months of fiscal year 21, July, August, and September, our actual fares were within the slow and steady cone that we presented within the fiscal year 21 budget, but favorable to the midline that we used in the budget. So we were closer to the top of the cone. Cumulatively, for the first 3 months, fares were favorable to budget by a little over $10 million. What we just presented shows that for the month of October, fares were only slightly favorable to budget, closer to that center line, so only above budget by $1.2 million. As we usually do, there's more details in the back of this presentation, specifically page 12, that show more details on revenue for the month itself. We continue to monitor fares and ridership very closely given the circumstances. And while we have not closed the books on the month of November, it's clear that the flattening trend is continuing through the month of November and was not a month of slow and steady improvement relative to the prior month. In all likelihood, November will be the first month of the fiscal year where revenue will fall short of the amount budgeted. Despite the good news on the vaccine front, there's no obvious catalyst for the flattening trend to improve in the very short term, putting the full year forecast for fares specifically in some jeopardy. That said, however, given the favorable variance in labor and fringe that we've experienced resulting from the policy of only filling essential positions for the first half of the fiscal year, given the buffer that we built into the budget from the cautious use of CARES Act funds, both in materials and supplies, and the assumption that we would carry over CARES Act funds into fiscal year 22, I continue to believe at the full year fiscal 21, we are still well positioned to weather the flattening of ridership and fares and meet the budget adopted in October. So with those comments, Jeff, I'll turn it back to you to complete the rest of the presentation. Thanks.
No problem. Thank you, Bill. So moving to slide three, this next slide further illustrates the revenue ridership declines throughout the month of October and frankly since March. Just to note, these charts have changed slightly this month, where we are now showing the 7-day moving average of ticket sale declines in the top chart for both bus and rail. And we've added the bottom chart, which provides additional detail on revenue and ridership trends within our bus submarkets. The declines in the total value of daily single ride purchases at the end of October were 54% for bus and 74% for rail, comparable to level declines at the end of September. As Bill mentioned, we've in essence flattened out over the past couple of months. As on any given day, ticket sales were really within a narrow band of 2 or 3% average variability off of a midpoint. Specifically to bus, our intrastate market has returned to approximately 50% of our pre-COVID levels. However, our northern interstate market to and from New York City remains substantially below prior year's results. October 2020 monthly ticket sales remained at 68% and 98% below October 2019 sales for bus and for rail, respectively. Moving to the next slide, slide four. Our operating cash balance at October 31st, 2020 was $66.6 million, a $68.1 million decrease from September. On October 31st, 2020, we had no outstanding balance on the credit facility, and our long-term debt balance was $1,138 million. The next slide illustrates the status of our CARES Act grant. In the month of October, we drew down $50 million in CARES Act funds for eligible expenses, bringing the total drawn down through October 31st to $680.7 million. In November, we drew down an additional $50 million, and as of the end of November, we have drawn $730.7 million, which is approximately 51% of our total allocation. Generally speaking, eligible expenses for CARES Act drawdowns to date would include labor and fringe benefits, purchase transportation, professional services, electric propulsion power, and fuel for revenue vehicles. Of these expenses, the majority, or 63% of the funds, have been to support labor and fringe. Last month, we executed our MOU with the state of New Jersey related to the Coronavirus Relief Funds, or CRF, appropriated to New Jersey Transit. These funds in the amount of $30 million also support labor and fringe and were received by New Jersey Transit on November 2nd. Next, I want to call your attention to a new slide, which will be included in the appendix, specifically page 8 of the report this month. This slide presents our fare box recovery ratio corporate-wide and by mode, and together with the new slide on slide 2, will assist in tracking our recovery efforts and planning for future needs. While that concludes the financial report, one last note is that I want to advise the committee that the Quinquennial Study of New Jersey Transit's Financial Management and Budget Reporting Practices, being prepared by Guidehouse, is in final draft form and is on target for completion in advance of the December 19, 2020 deadline, as mandated by Public Law 2018, Chapter 162. The report will be made available to board members once finalized. Thank you, and that concludes my report.
Thank you for the report. Board Member Morocco, any questions or comments?
Just one general question. Obviously, it's disappointing that the ridership has returned along the least optimistic projections, and I'm glad that you all had those worst case scenario projections, because apparently that is serving us well. The question I have is, what have you found in terms of the changing nature of the riders? So, for example, obviously, I'm assuming that ridership across the Hudson for office workers on those standard rush hour trips have gone down significantly, while other non-standard trips have recovered more quickly. Could I ask what you found generally in terms of that and how you're using that to project going forward?
This is Jeremy, Board Member of Morocco. This is Jeremy Colangelo. I could take a shot at that. I'm the chief planner, and my group works very closely with our colleagues in finance to try to get at the exact questions you're asking. So, you're absolutely correct. The New York market is definitely the lagging market, and the New York rail market is actually lagging the New York bus market. So something like, again, in broad strokes, we're at about 20% or so on the New York rail market, somewhere in the 30s, if that, on the New York bus market. And that, of course, compares to the local market on bus, which is, you know, which is 50% or greater, depending on sort of the specific submarket you're looking at. And what one of the things that my group does is we sort of engage with the business community, with, you know, for example, in New York, the economic development people in New York, others who are sort of involved in looking at recovery there, certainly talking with, you know, the Meadowlands Regional Chamber, Newark Business Partnership, you know, a lot of the different organizations as well. To process what we're hearing from them, to understand where and how they're thinking about bringing folks back to work. Obviously, early on in the pandemic, there was a big focus in providing service for essential workers, so the medical community, folks in distribution, those sorts of things. And now we're really looking at, you know, that market's been pretty consistent since March. But what is the future of those other markets who tend to have the work from home options and have frankly been taking advantage of those options in pretty strong numbers for the last 8 months? So that's an ongoing discussion, and we try to do what we can, because that's influenced by everything from the potential for a vaccine to school closings and those sorts of things, right? So it's a sort of a multivariate situation that we try to get a handle on. So hopefully that provides a little answer to your question.
It does, and obviously no one has a crystal ball, but I'm gathering what you're saying is the data supports what I think we've all presumed, which is, you know, cross Hudson passenger trips are down, and that's largely driven by, you know, the changing nature of office work. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I'd probably just add also, you know, New York as such a big tourism market, a recreation market. So you don't, not mm-hmm. only do you not have tourists and recreation, mm-hmm. you have all those support functions, right? So when New York was having 65 million visitors a year, a lot of those people were international. But a lot of people were going to work at hotels, at restaurants, et cetera. You know, obviously Broadway shut down, right? So there's the office market, and then there's the other whole other part of the economy there, which hasn't come back as well. But absolutely, that's correct.
Don't go.
Yeah.
Just okay.
Very useful. Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you. Board Member Adams, any questions or comments?
Yes, Joyce. I do have a question, and if Jeff could just go over the slide that says, I think it's CARES Act drawdown summary. I think I'd probably be the one who would have requested this, and I just want him just to explain it again slowly, just so I understand how much money we started out with, what we spent in 2000, in fiscal year 20, what we're anticipating in 21, and I'm assuming whatever's left over would be for 22. And then I have a couple other questions. But Jeff, if you could just explain that and see if I got the numbers right.
Sure, Board Member Adams, no problem. Our CARES Act grants, and I'm going to go into a little bit more detail, is actually split into two sections. There's an amount of $1.423 billion through Section 5307, which is used to support New Jersey Transit's operations, as well as an amount of $13 million through Section 5311, which is mainly passed through to our local programs. So I'm going to stick with the number of 1.423 as the quote-unquote allocation to New Jersey Transit when I discuss this. However, technically, we also received the $13 million from 5311, which is, again, not for our use per se, but for our local programs and local partners.
Okay.
Of that 360.8 million was drawn down in fiscal 20. And that's the middle chart on slide 5.
Okay.
So that left a total of $1,062,200,000 for use in fiscal 20 and beyond. As of the end of October, we drew down an additional $320 million, which would have left $742,200,000 for future use. And then in November, we've drawn an additional $50 million. So as of today, a total of $682.2 million remaining for use going forward.
Okay, just stop there. So if I look at the chart and I go all the way to the right, the fiscal 21 CARES allocation is up to October and doesn't include November is what you're saying.
Correct, as this is the report itself is through the end date of October 31st, but we're providing the November numbers and, you know, kind of up-to-date numbers in our speaking presentation as we have those available.
That makes everything you said so far makes perfect sense. So the remaining CARES Act funding is eligible for drawdown in fiscal year 2021?
As we incur eligible expenses.
That gets to my next question. So I'm making this up. If you had $20 million in eligible expenses, you could draw down 20. If you had 50 in eligible expenses, you could draw down 50. Is that thinking is correct?
On a highest level, yes.
Okay. Now, the eligible expenses, I know there's probably some complicated chart or whatever. How do we determine that an expense is eligible? For example, somebody says, I want to use CARES Act funding to do ABC. Is there somebody in the organization that says, hey, look, you can't use CARES Act funding for this. You can only use 60% of CARES Act funding for this. And the reason I'm asking the question is, I don't want to get to the end of the CARES Act funding and then the feds come back and say 20 or 30% of what you spent is not eligible for drawdown after we've audited it, if that's even possible.
So I'll answer your second point first. We actually leave a fair amount of expenses as undrawn down, particularly most of our materials and supplies expenses, for a couple of reasons. The first is that we are pursuing reimbursement for some of those activities through FEMA. This is true for some of our services as well. So we're not touching them. We want to make sure that we're not ever going to be in a state where we're double count. And yes, we have a fairly large, complex spreadsheet that tracks all of this. And the second is really for the instance that you just mentioned, Board Member Adams, where after the fact, through a triennial or another audit, it's determined that a specific expense would not have been eligible for federal reimbursement, that we have leftover expenses that were not drawn down, that if need be, we hope it doesn't come to this, but if need be, in theory, we can swap those, which I believe was your second point.
Okay.
Board Member Adams, this is Bill Vaccaro. I think part of what you're asking about is how we monitor what's eligible. I just want to highlight in addition to what Jeff said, you know, from the outset, we had established a team that goes across a number of departments, not only finance, but members from compliance, from the capital programs department. If you know, team members who have worked extensively with federal grants throughout their careers at New Jersey Transit and others. And so it is a combination of people on this team, which crosses a number of different departments, who have been evaluating from the outset what are eligible expenses to the extent necessary. We've conferred with the FTA to ensure that our understanding of the rules and the regulations are appropriate and that we're spending the funds in ways that are consistent with the CARES Act regulations. So I think part of what you're getting at is just that level of comfort that we're looking at that and that someone isn't going to come back and say, well, that's not eligible. You know, we think we have that pretty well covered in understanding the rules, the regulations, the procurement processes necessary for certain expenses to be eligible, as well as what are not eligible expenses.
Okay.
And I think also you may have touched on the expiration. Sorry to interrupt you again. There is no expiration on the CARES Act funds. I think somewhere in there you mentioned whether we can use it for eligible expenses in 21. The CARES Act funds don't expire, which is another kind of attractive feature of the way this it was structured.
Great. And Bill, both for you and Jeff, and I know this is new to everybody, and nobody knows all the intricacies behind this, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, and that you guys were taking a look at it, checking the numbers, checking it twice to make sure we don't have to write a check to the feds. I can see you probably don't. But let me just ask one last question. Out of all of your expenses, is there a percentage that could be considered non-CARES? And I know that's question. Like, for example, are you saying 95% of the expenses you're sure based on your reading is care, but there could be 5% or 2% that the feds could come back and question? Do you have a feel for that?
And
your number might be 100%.
Yeah, I think the way we are going about, you know, allowing for a buffer of having eligible expenses well beyond what we're actually using to support our spending, I feel comfortable that there is not a likelihood of that happening, where we would have to be returning funds. For example, you know, there are categories of expenses that we know are not eligible. For example, preventative maintenance. So we don't count preventive maintenance as an eligible expense in allocating or drawing down CARES Act funds. And we've also allowed for expenses that we think are eligible, but we're not necessarily counting them as eligible. If we had to, I think Jeff alluded to earlier, if we had to swap something in, if it were turned out that we had categorized something, we could swap something else in that we know is eligible expense.
Okay. And just this is one last question, and this is probably I'm probably getting into the weeds, and Kevin will probably yell at me for this question. But you say underneath your asterisk where it says others, It said includes smaller expense categories, utilities, fuel, material supplies, taxes. What taxes would that include? That just seems like an odd thing there, taxes.
I can get back to you through the chair. It's a very, very small line item for us.
Okay.
I can get back to you exactly what that is.
Okay, I was just curious to know what taxes we paid, but that's fine. If it's very, very small and insignificant, that's fine. Joyce, I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Okay.
No problem.
Thank you. Board Member Osmani, any questions or comments?
Just a couple of questions. On slide 3, Jeff, where we talk about revenue and ridership, I was just trying to understand what's happening north intrastate, where we see that the ridership number is doing way better than the revenue number. And maybe this is what you were alluding to answer to a previous question. Are we just seeing riders take shorter trips? Is that what's happening? That the number of riders is rising, but the revenue isn't?
So as a general rule for bus, that's true. Not necessarily the shorter trips, but the mix of trips is shifting to the intrastate being weighted higher than the intrastate was now weighted higher than, in terms of our total ridership, than interstate was historically. And obviously the intrastate is a lower dollar fare than most of our interstate service.
I was looking at the solid blue line and the dotted blue line. And I think solid blue line, if my understanding is correct, shows the dollar amount from intrastate. And the dotted line is the ridership. Both lines represent intrastate use. And I was trying to understand why, while the ridership is going up, the revenue for the same ridership is not going up.
I think it's pretty close. We can get back to you with the actual data. It's non-graphical, but looking at the solid line, which is revenue plotted on the left side axis, started at about 10 million, now approximately at 5 million. Looking at the ridership on the blue dotted line on the right axis, started at about 7.5 to 8 million, and now it's about 375 to 4 million.
Okay, so it is quite corresponding, yes.
So there probably is some element of the longer trips not being taken, but nothing that we can really discern as a trend within the data.
Great. And my last question is on the outstanding debt balances. The short-term debt has pretty much come down to zero. Is it because of, again, CARES Act, where not only it's providing funding, it's also providing liquidity?
The CARES Act has provided liquidity. The CARES Act has provided us liquidity where we may have used a credit facility in prior years to bridge between when the expenses are occurred that are federally eligible and when we receive the grants from the federal government. So it has provided us with some liquidity and approximately $300,000 in interest cost savings from not having to use a credit facility this year as compared to last year.
Sounds good. Thank you. Those are my questions, Joyce.
Thank you. Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
Yes. A comment. First of all, let me just thank Jeff and Bill for your excellent presentation. I would like to comment on a different subject. Although it is clearly a subject that is the responsibility of this committee, and that is the oversight of financial control systems. It is the prime responsibility of this committee and by extension, the full board. The recent allegations about Academy Bus I've raised serious questions about the efficacy of our financial control systems. If the allegations are true, those control systems are either weak or non-existent. The governor's veto message called for us to investigate these issues as they affect our organization. And the thought occurred to me that it would be important for us to get a set of outside eyes to look at the quality of our control systems and to make recommendations on ways they can be strengthened. The thought I had was, since Deloitte is our auditor and familiar with our organization, and Deloitte is an organization that is known for having a good deal of expertise in things like financial control systems, that it would be appropriate for them to take a look at how we can improve our system of controls. And if that exercise would present a conflict with their auditing responsibilities, that we ought to turn to some other organization like North Highland or some management consulting firm or auditing organization with expertise in this area. But in any case, I think we need to get some outsiders to take a look at our system of financial controls and make recommendations for strengthening them. And I would welcome the thoughts of my colleagues on the board and the staff members on this call. If you have some ideas about this and your reaction to doing such a thing, I would value your comments.
Board member Gordon, this is Bill Vicara. Certainly appreciate the significance of the issue, the importance of our internal controls as we discuss those at audit committee on a regular basis, and have a very active internal audit function. Deloitte also, as part of their year-end audit, looks at our controls and found no overall deficiencies. So that said, I certainly have no issue, going back and looking at whether this could be evaluated differently or looked at differently. I would be concerned about using Deloitte and putting them in a position that would conflict them with the audit, which is kind of our utmost, I think, importance in how we use Deloitte would be to keep them as an independent, in a position where they're an independent auditor, but there could potentially be other firms who could put eyes on this if that was the preference of the board. I also think John O'Hearn is on the call, and I don't know if John would like to add to that.
Yes, thanks, Board Member Gordon and Bill. Board Member Gordon, you had mentioned this on a prior briefing, this concept of having Deloitte look at this. My group in internal audit had already planned to look at the technology solution that will help us move away from the private carriers self-reporting mistrips to using a technology solution to allow private carriers to track and monitor the mistrips. I echo Bill's sentiment. I prefer not to use Deloitte. What we have in internal audit is that we have Jefferson Wells, another national public accounting firm that already handles a lot of our IT audits that are beyond the skill set of internal audit. So it is our intent to actually audit the new technology solution, which is supposed to be up and running by the end of this calendar year, so the end of December. What we want to look at is what you're talking about, not just the IT system itself, but the plan for business controls. That is, who has access to data, who can monitor the data, who can manipulate the data. So we'll want to see that. And as Bill says, it's actually better to leave Deloitte independent, because then if needed, we could have them go review the business controls. But our intent in internal audit was to use Jefferson Wells to audit not just the new technology solution, but the business controls around that solution. If it gets up and running by the end of the year, we'd want probably 60, 90 days of data before assessing it. But again, we're already starting that, we'll start planning that. So we can start working on that probably in the second quarter of calendar year 2021. So that's our plan for that. So we concur with your recommendation. We concur, with your concerns.
Okay, thank you. I fully appreciate your concerns about preserving the independence of Deloitte. Totally understand that. You know, I'm also wondering whether, in addition to some kind of technological fix to track contract carrier vehicles, whether there's value in having a more human element, such as a system of spotters. And it was my understanding that at one point we had people from an outside organization who were riding our buses just to provide some additional quality control, but they were also, I thought, actually tracking to see whether the contract carriers were fulfilling their quota of trips. I'm wondering whether we should do that. And just one other comment. It is my understanding that there was actually, John, your team did an audit, I believe, in 2019 on the issue of missed trips. I was told it was audit number 20-052. If that in fact exists, I think it would be valuable for the whole board to get a copy of that report just as background for our continuing discussion of maintaining oversight of our contract carriers.
Yes, that's you have the correct audit report number, and I can share that through Joyce.
Very good. Thank
and then
you.
Ron could probably best, if Ron Nichols is on, the status of the actual spotters.
Yes, John, I'm on. Yes, we still have spotters through customer service that monitor our contract carriers and private carriers by riding on the buses as undercover riders and reporting back. Going forward, we're expanding the department to have regional supervisors out on the road watching the contract carriers as well. This is something I've planned starting in the new year.
Well, that's that's great to hear, because I mean, apparently for 5 years, if these allegations are true, we weren't picking up on the severity of the problem because it was a whistleblower who blew the whistle, and we didn't pick it up internally. So clearly we need some kind of internal mechanism to do the monitoring and exercise the controls. So I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you.
Board Member Gordon, it's Kevin, just to augment, certainly always looking to tighten controls. Again, there's a batch of information that I think as a case is tried or resolved, there's different procedures that will come out, lessons learned from the complexity of this fraud, assuming the allegations are correct, from the highest level, sort of reminds me of a Tyco kind of thing. I mean, really, it's, extremely disappointing if true, to put it mildly. But still, on the internal control side, on our side, as mentioned, we're always looking to tighten those up, both with technology, but also on the human resource side. So we did, though, as far as for the group, and a lot of these years predate, my being here. This goes back to 2012. Was that the organization was resource starved, as you know, both on IT and on the human resource side, but that they did know it. It wasn't like they were ignorant. They knew that there were missed trips, and we had, Ron, I forget, was it, $9 million in fines, et cetera, they were tracking, it just was not adequate to the degree of be able to catch that degree of missed trips and the particularly with the complexity of the scam that was going on. But Ron, what was the total amount that we had fined Academy?
About $5.9 million just for missed trip penalties alone.
Now, so that those are the ones we caught, but it was like whack-a-mole, and clearly we need to tighten that up. And
right.
Are doing so, particularly with technology investments.
Okay. Thank you very much. No further questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
Yeah, first comment, excellent report from both Jeff and Bill, and definitely appreciate that. And I guess I have a question. I want to piggyback on what Board Member Morocco was kind of digging into a little bit, which was the drop-off on ridership, particularly on the commuter side, because that would become the more consistent and reliable source of ridership that we had. And so we know from the statistics that there was a tremendous drop-off for the New York commuter into, you know, the commuter into New York. The question I have is, do we have any way to determine how many of the, which what I would call pre-COVID commuters, have since or continued to commute into New York, but have opted for another means of transportation, probably more likely their own automobile? And if we know and understand that percentage or where that number is at, is there anything that we can do to convince them? And we've heard some other conversations about this in other meetings and so on and so forth, ensuring that they know that they have a reliable service to come back to, a clean service to come back to, you know, one that's sanitary and so on and so forth, that would entice them to leave the automobile that they maybe are currently doing and come back to us.
Board Member Morocco, this is Jeremy Colangelo again. We have done surveys of folks who have sort of taken a leave from the system for a little while. While there is some degree of folks taking, you know, driving cars into Manhattan, it's not, at least as far as we can tell, and of course this is all self-reported by our, you know, survey respondents, it is not a particularly significant percentage. You know, so from that perspective, I don't think we're seeing a huge dip. I mean, it's more a function of the macroeconomic trends that are limiting that ridership. And I'd leave it, I guess, for others if we want to talk about the things we're doing to try to encourage folks to take transit, to explain, you know, everything from the cleaning and disinfection to the how full is my ride app, you know, all the various activities underway to try to give our customers that sense of assurance that I think you're referencing.
Okay, so it sounds like we're doing all that we can to capture that ridership. It seems like it's just not a big percentage to recapture to begin with. So that does answer the question. I appreciate that.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next is the Human Resources Update, Jean Victor.
Good morning. Before I go over the HR dashboard for October, I wanted to follow up on my report from the August and September dashboard, in which I went over some of the initiatives currently underway in Human Resources. The one initiative I wanted to highlight today is the supervisory training program that was launched this summer. It's called Supervisor Superstars. It is a program mainly for new supervisors and for supervisors who are new to New Jersey Transit. The goal is to introduce the participants to leadership principles, which include learning to manage for performance, learning to manage for development, a review of the HR policies that supervisors should be aware of, and other supervisory resources that are available to them, diversity and inclusion, ethics, EEO, and a review of the hiring process. Throughout the modules, concepts of diversity, equity, and inclusion have been interwoven. We've completed two cycles of the 14 modules and will begin our third cycle after the start of the new year. The course is offered over a 7-week period. Now, turning to the HR dashboard for October of 2020,
HR has 400 positions to fill. That's broken out by 130 for administration, 141 for bus operations, 124 for rail operations, and 5 for light rail. During the month of October, we hired a total of 102 employees. It was broken down by 13 in administration, 44 in bus operations, and in bus operations, those 44 really consisted of about 30 bus operators, 6 servicemen, 4 foremen, and 3 cleaners. We also hired 44 in rail operations, which consisted of 29 assistant conductors, 8 trackmen, 2 cleaners, and a few other positions. We hired 1 in light rail. We had a total of 34 promotions for the month. There were 6 in administration, 3 in bus operations, 25 in rail operations, which included 14 locomotive engineers that were promoted, and we also had some senior training specialists that were promoted, as well as a few other titles. As far as job reclassifications were concerned, we had 2 in administration, 5 in bus operations, for a total of 7. For retirements, we had 1 in bus operations, 6 in rail operations, for a total of 7. And for separations other than for retirement, we had a total of 33, which were comprised of 5 for administration, 15 for bus operations, which were primarily bus operators, 13 for rail operations, which partly were locomotive engineer trainees, for a total of 33. For disciplinary actions, we had 1 suspension in administration, 75 in bus operations, 26 in rail operations, for a total of 102. And for discharges, we had 3 in administration and 1 in rail operations, for a total of 4. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Board Member Morocco, any questions or comments?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Adams, any questions or comments?
Yes, Joyce, I do. And thank you, Jean, for that report. That supervisor's superstar training sounds like a wonderful program. So my question does have to do with the human resource dashboard, but it also has to do with another slide that was presented, and I think it was, I'm going to try to go to it, history of vacancies, and then the slide after. I'm really confused about the number of vacancies. Is it 600? Is it 500? Is it 400? I'm confused by all the different numbers and all the different slides.
What I have attempted to do in my report is to tell you the number of positions I have to fill, which might be and is often different from the number of vacancies that there are. So finance keeps track of the number of vacancies within New Jersey Transit, and when there's a vacancy, our management will requisition the vacancy in order to have HR fill that position. So in order not to confuse the issue, I have just referred to what I am working on as the number of positions to fill. It's really the number of requisitions that have been processed or that are being processed.
All right, since this is your turn, we'll stick to your numbers, and I'm sure somebody will explain to me the difference between the 400 that you are charged to fill and the other numbers. And if they're budgeted numbers that aren't going to be filled in the near term, that's fine. That's a question for Kevin, because that is one of my questions. But I did have another question about the positions. I took a quick look on the New Jersey Transit website. There's only 53 openings on the website. Now, I know that some of them are duplicative when you're talking about bus operators or rail operators, but I just can't get to 400 positions for you to fill, and there's only 53 openings on the website.
Right, and some of those positions are agreement positions that we fill. We don't post those on the website. Our positions that we post on the website, we usually post them there. We post them on Indeed, and we post them on LinkedIn. So they are in various stages of being processed. Some might be at the sourcing stage, but some might be at the interview stage where we've taken down the posting. So, you know, it can, even though the requisition is still open, the actual requisitions are in different stages. So even when we get through the interview process and we're going through the selection process and we're going through onboarding, you know, those positions might still be open as a vacancy until someone actually occupies the seat, but they will not be posted on our website at that point.
Okay.
Board Member Adams, this is Jeff Bernstein. If I can just jump in for a second to add to what Jean said previously, there are a number of positions in the budget which were newly approved for fiscal 21, but yet we have not authorized that they be filled, and they're not funded until January of 2021. Technically, those are positions that we have, and they're showing as vacant, but they are not, quote-unquote, available for Gene's team to start the recruiting process or for the units to start requisitioning those positions to be filled. And that's uniquely different this year than in prior years, and that's why you'll be seeing some discrepancies between the numbers that were presented on the history of vacancies slide versus the number of requisitions that Jean is presenting in her slide.
And I'm assuming there's some way to reconcile these numbers, because my next question had to do with some of the specific numbers, but now based on what you said, it's no use in me asking the questions, because where it says history of vacancies, those numbers aren't the numbers necessarily that Gene is working
on. Correct.
Maybe I could, sort of give from the, the overall perspective, to your questions. I think, issue with when the pandemic hit and financially, agreement, the union positions, there's a bid system, so those jobs aren't posted as part of, as you bid those positions, they open up within, as per collective bargaining agreements. So that's, significant, other that, on the delta between what is you see on the website versus the number of vacancies. But then on the non-agreement side, obviously with the restriction from the governor's office, as well as good, prudence, as we covered with Board Member Fulton earlier, financially, we don't want to hire people, so we have those positions in the budget. We're looking, assuming either CARES Act or when we know that's responsible, and we see, where we start coming out of it, tunnel, those are positions. A lot of them are ones that, although not critical for, operations, are, long-term. I mean, a lot of things that we need to do run the organization. To be a best-in-class agency. But we don't want to hire people and then lay them off 6 months later. So we're being cautious on anything other than what is, which is why it's unusual compared to our, pre-COVID delta between what's open and what's posted or, up for bid, and what we have showing in the budget as vacant.
Okay, and that goes to my next question. So, Kevin, I'm going to make a suggestion. I suggest that something should come out from you or your office really explaining this, saying that, and I'm making up these numbers, there's 600 approved vacancies, 500 are in the budget, 400 are going to be filled by the administration, 100 are temporarily on hold or froze based on the governor and financial prudence. That way, these numbers that are presented to us make sense, because right now, I was kind of confused about what are we going to fill, what are we not going to fill, when are we going to fill them? And then I went to the website, and it was even worse because I only saw 50-some positions. And the explanation the staff is given makes perfect sense to me, but I can't gain that understanding based on the material that was submitted. Now, you did mention something that I want a little bit more clarity on. You mentioned that based on the bargaining unit or bargaining agreement, some positions can't be posted?
Yeah, no, the positions in the collective bargaining agreement, that's, you know, those positions are up for bid within the within the union contracts. So they, you know, we don't hire from outside. You have to be a union member, and there's a whole process that goes with being that member, and then seniority, and, you know, the in the pick, when you go put a position up and you have a pick, there's the different criteria than if we were hiring, you know, for a non-union from the general public.
Okay, and since I'm sure most of my other board members are... That should somehow be separated a little bit, because when I look at the work that Jean has to do and she tells me I have to hire 400 people, I'm thinking it's 400 people. You have to advertise, you have to interview, you have to go to the outside, and if some of these are going to be hired from within due to union agreements, then maybe that should be separated. It's something to look at. I don't want to give her any more work, but maybe it's something something that maybe we need to look at if it's not going to be a publicly advertised position.
Sure, I don't think it's easy for me to say it's Jean who has to do the work, but and her staff. But I think that data is readily available. So I think for the board and for the committee, we can break that down to show that. And internally, the communications, you know, through the executive management team, we have regular EMT meetings and communication. So internally, you know, the senior staff know it, and they should be communicating that down to, you know, their staff in each one of their departments. So I think it's internally, it's pretty well known, the current status and situation. But for the board, we can do that, you know, give that breakdown clear so you can, you know, understand without having to triangulate.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Joyce, my last question has to do with the bus ops suspensions. Can somebody give me a general reason? I'm saying it's a lot. It might not be a lot, but 75 people suspended from one division or department in a month does seem like a lot. Was there something, an overriding reason or a commonality between these suspensions?
Yeah, Board Member Adams, this is Mike Kilcoyne. During the height of the pandemic, beginning in April, bus operations suspended all disciplinary hearings to stop in-person meetings in close proximity to each other. And that went all the way through August and into September. So what you're seeing is the backlog being caught up as we implemented disciplinary hearings once again. Many of which are being done remotely now. But once we get done with our negotiations with the union on how to safely conduct those hearings, you're seeing a lot of the backlog that's coming through the system now.
Okay. All right. So this isn't 75 people doing something wrong in one month. This is catching up with times when you weren't doing any hearings.
Yeah, there's, you know, remembering there's 5,500 people that are subject to these contracts and disciplines. There is quite a considerable backlog over many months when you're talking about, you know, 17,000 bus trips a day. A lot can, you know, it's pretty complicated. A lot can go wrong. So a lot of this is, you know, bringing people in to discuss with them an interaction with a customer, for instance, for a customer complaint. And that's considered a hearing and that gets added. And, you know, sometimes that generates a negative result. Because we believe you should have handled it differently, and you know, you will have progressive discipline as a result. Everything from accidents, every single interaction, everything that gets done, a disciplinary hearing is conducted to get to the bottom of it. So the short answer to your question is that is the result of the backlogs, and those things can go back 6 months ago. Due to the suspension, we haven't been able to hold your hearing till now.
Okay. All right. Now that explains it. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Joyce. I don't have any other comments or questions.
Okay. Thank you. Board Member Ashmani, any questions or comments? Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
No questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
No questions, no comments. Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you. Next is the Equal Employment Opportunity and Affirmative Action Update. Naheem Din.
Good morning, distinguished members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you again. Since we are meeting a month after our last presentation, this report only provides data for October instead of the usual 2 months. I'm starting with the highlights page. The Office of EEO and Affirmative Action has continued processing new complaints in a timely manner. As of the end of October, there were 43 open complaints compared with 110 open complaints at the end of January of this year. Excuse me. Sexual harassment and discrimination prevention training is being provided online as well as via live virtual training. Bus and Rail are continuing their negotiations of side agreements with the remaining unions to train agreement employees. As part of their professional development, members of our staff are also receiving training. In October, for instance, Satori Samura, Director of EEO Affirmative Action, attended an online training program for mid-level managers offered by the prestigious Eno Transportation Center. This program trains transportation professionals from across the country to be effective leaders. The next slide shows the number of complaints that were opened as well as closed on a monthly basis. So this is only for October. In October, 4 new complaints were filed and 10 pending investigations are closed. The next slide shows pending complaints by basis and by action. The pie chart on the left shows the basis on which complaints were filed. The most frequently cited bases were discrimination based on gender, that's 28%, race, 28%, color, 11%, disability, 7%, as well as retaliation, also 7%. The pie chart on the right shows complaints filed by action. The most frequently cited allegation was non-sexual harassment at 61%, followed by sexual harassment at 15%.
You're real good at punching out women. How are you with men?
I'm sorry? Of the complaints alleging non-sexual harassment, most alleged workplace harassment based on race and age. The following slide, which is slide 4, provides information on cases which were closed. So by the end of October, 95% of the 2017 cases were closed. However, as of now, all of the 2017 cases have been closed. Additionally, we closed 91% of the 2018 cases. So of the 134 complaints which were filed in 2018, 12 were pending at the end of October. We closed 89% of the 2019 cases, and of the 82 cases filed in 2019, 9 were pending. Additionally, 66% of the cases filed from January through October of this year have been closed. So the breakdown of 10 cases which were closed in October is as follows. 2 were from 2017, 4 from 2018, 3 from 2019, and 1 from 2020. And this concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you for the report. Board Member Morocco, any questions or comments?
Yeah, one question. Again, I'm very happy to hear that you're continuing to train the staff on harassment and how to avoid it and identify it. You know, I've always been a strong proponent of training as the best method of preventing harassment from occurring in the first instance. My question is about the chart on the last page, which shows the number of cases opened and closed per year. And obviously, it looks like the trend line from 2018 to 2020, in terms of total new cases, is certainly going in the right direction. I guess my question is, can you talk to me a little bit about why the closed cases in 2020 are so low, both numerically and as a percentage of the new cases?
So what this means is that it doesn't mean that in 2018 we closed, at the end of the year we closed 91% cases. And can you hear me?
I'm getting some feedback.
Yeah, I am too.
Yeah, if, for other people, if you're not speaking, you can mute. Well, it sounds like it's someone not on mute. Thanks.
Okay. So actually what it's showing is that as of the end of October, we had closed 91% of the 2018 cases, for instance, the cases which were backlogged. And we also closed 89% of the 2019 cases, which were, of course, backlogged. And we also closed all of the 2017 cases, which have been backlogged. So it is showing how we're progressing, through this year, how at the end of October we have handled not only the cases filed this year, but cases which had been filed previous years, which had been backlogged. So we have been bringing the backlog places to a closure, and we are doing well, actually, very well, actually, in closing the cases which had been filed this year.
I understand. So what you're saying is that the orange bar shows the total number of cases that were opened in 2018. How many of them are closed as of today?
Yep.
Yes, sir. That clarifies it. Thank you.
So as I said, this shows you that at the end of October, we had 95% of the 2017 cases closed, but now we have closed all of them. So next time you won't see 2017, you will only see, hopefully we'll close most of the 2018 cases as well, and hopefully all of 2019 or most of 2019. So that percentage will go much higher than it is now.
Excellent. I look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Board Member Adams, any questions or comments?
No question, Joyce. Just one comment. Keep up the good work reducing the cases. And I am also one who feels strongly that, training and education is one of the best ways to reduce harassment complaints. So keep up the good work. Thank you, Joyce. That's all for me.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. For the record, Board Member Ajmani had to leave the meeting. Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
No questions or comments. Thank you. Good report. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank
Board
you.
Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
No questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Board members, that concludes the agenda for the Administration Committee. Thank you for your participation, and you may disconnect your line.